working today. All right, so welcome to lecture 3 of 162. Today we're going to talk about concurrency, and we're going to talk about processes, threads, and address spaces. So just to review, last time we talked about the history of operating systems, and one of the big questions was, well, why do we study operating systems in the first place? And it was really to understand how, as the user needs have changed and the hardware abilities have changed, operating systems have adapted and offered new functionality and flexibility. There were several distinct phases, remember, that we went through. We went through this phase where hardware was very expensive and people were cheap, and then we went through this phase where hardware was moderately expensive but people were more expensive, and then we went through this phase, or we are in this phase now, where hardware is very cheap and it's the people that are expensive. And so it's, what can we do with this inexpensive hardware to enable people to do more interesting things. The other thing also is, if we look at the history of change, that rapid change has really heavily influenced operating system design. We're going to continue to see this when we start to look at file systems, when we start to look at memory management systems. We'll see how the balance has changed as technologies have made processors faster, but memory hasn't grown as fast. Or certainly disks have not grown in speed as quickly as memory has grown in speed. And tape and CD-ROMs and DVDs have not grown in speed as fast as disk drives have grown in speed. So we'll continue to see the effects of these changing Moore's law curves. The other important thing we saw was a gradual migration of features from the mainframe, mini computer, down to the PC, and ultimately now down to the handheld. I think the interesting thing is you know, kind of what's next? You know, is it going to be down to the wristwatch level in terms of that functionality? And then the last thing was complexity. So we're at a stage now where we're back to where we were back in the 60s in terms of complexity. We have these massive operating systems. It's hard to deliver them on time, and it requires a huge human effort to build these systems. You'll get a little bit of a taste of that in this class when you start playing with nachos, but nothing like what it would be like going to work for Microsoft or any other large software company. Okay, so this is just that graph I had before, and again, we see features and functionality migrating from, you know, literally four decades ago. Now it's starting to show up in the handheld environment. And again, you know, right now, you know, can anyone think of a reason, for example, why I might want to have my wristwatch be multi-threaded? Now, why would I want to have a multi-threaded wristwatch? Sync to the atomic clock. Well, I could probably get away with a single thread to do that. I just periodically, you know, would go in and listen for the signal. Yeah. Alarm ringtones. Yeah, if I wanted to play multimedia ringtones while still counting time, maybe I'd have a separate thread that would play the polyphonic ringtones. Yeah. Yeah, and I have multiple counters, definitely. That would be useful to have multiple threads. What else? Yeah. Yeah, but text messaging. Why not turn my watch into a pager and allow it to receive messages in real time? I see people laughing. So there's that. You can actually go out and buy a watch like that. I think it's the Fossil company makes it. It's the Microsoft watch, the Spot watch. And it actually doesn't use paging technology. It listens to FM subcarriers, FM radio subcarriers, and it'll tell you the current temperature or weather forecast or stock, or you can send a whole bunch of different information to your watch. So there you actually want to have multiple threads so you can be listening to the radio at the same time that you're actually updating the clock and doing the normal wristwatch functions. Yeah, did you have a question? Okay. The other reason why you might want to is because there are also PDA watches. IBM a couple of years ago built a watch that ran Linux. It had a completely soft display for displaying analog time, actually, but it was all done with LCDs. So there's lots of reasons to think that, you know, we're not going to stop here. We're going to just keep going smaller and smaller. Okay, so the other one of the other things we looked at was, how is the operating system implemented? And the important thing for this class is the question of policy versus mechanism. So when you turn in your design doc for each of the phases, one of the things the TA is going to be looking for is, did you separate out how you're going to do something from what it is that you want to do? So the how being the mechanism and the what being the policy. Each of those can change independently. I might decide to use a different paging policy, different scheduling mechanism or whatever under the covers. I want to be able to decouple them so that they're not tightly tied. Algorithms that you use, event models. We'll talk about this when we get into synchronization in more detail, but threads are what we're going to talk about today as a particular way of managing concurrency. The other way that people do it that's become very popular again is event loops, where you basically have a single thread, but it kind of switches between what it's doing. The event loop model is very attractive because of performance. It's the fastest performing model in terms of the overhead of switching from one thing to another is very, very small. The downside is it's much, much harder model to program in. And we'll look at examples of it so you can get a sense of what the complexity is. Okay, then the thing that fortunately you're not going to have to worry about, but lots of companies have to worry about, is backward compatibility issues. So this is an incredible nightmare for the Windows folks. Also over in Unix, we have the POSIX standard. So in Windows, you have the Win32 API. In the Unix world, you have the POSIX API. And you have to provide the ability to take an old program and run it on the current platform. If you look at things like the game environment, this is definitely true. The latest generation of PS3 has to be able to run the old PS whatever games. Same thing with the Xbox. Same thing with Macintosh. As they migrate from a PowerPC platform over to an Intel platform, they've had to develop a lot of technology to allow you to continue to run the old programs. And then finally, we have to deal with lots of different hardware platforms. And so if you're in that environment, like you're building lots of different PDAs or like Apple, where you want to be able to support two different platforms, you want tools that make it easy to create a generic operating system for that particular platform. So Windows, they provide the, I forget what it's called, it's like the hardware developer kit, which allows a manufacturer to customize that version of Windows for the specific chipsets and other interesting devices that they're shipping. Okay, so topics for today. How do we provide multi-programming? So we're going to look at uniprogramming, running one thing at a time, and look at how we extend that to provide multi-programming. We're also going to look at what are processes and basically how are they related to threads and address spaces. So concurrency is going to be done at the level of threads and address spaces. All right, so let's talk about concurrency. So we have a thread of execution. And what that is it's basically a sequential instruction stream where we execute these instruction fetch, decode, and execute operations. So it's like taking your program and we're just running through the program, read the instruction, decode the instruction, execute the instruction, update, perform any side effects, and keep going. This operates in some address space. The address space is all of the data that can affect the program or that a state that can affect the program or can be affected by this particular thread. Okay, so in environments like Microsoft DOS, early Macintosh, and batch processing, it was uniprogram. One thing happened at a time. This was really nice. Right? We don't have to worry about concurrency because we just define it away. Right? So if we can only do one thing, we don't have to worry about conflicting operations. There's only one task to worry about. You could ask the question, why don't we have PCs or change this to PDA or change this to wristwatches that are uniprogrammed? Well, I think it should be obvious now because we want to do multiple things, right? You want to be able to, print your source code while you're playing that first-person shooter game. Multiprogramming. So multiprogramming is basically being able to run more than one thread at a time. And some of the later operating systems and most of all of the current operating systems, desktop operating systems and server operating systems, support some form of multiprogramming. Sometimes people call this multitasking, but that means something different. So we're going to use the terminology multiprogramming. Okay. So the basic problem of concurrency is basically the management of resources. We have a single CPU, we have a single memory, we have a single set of I/O devices. All right? But at the same time, we want to give users the illusion. So this is the reality, this nasty environment where there's only one CPU, and the reality is we want to run lots of applications. So we need to provide an API that makes users have this illusion that they have their own machine. So that's the goal. From the point of view of the threat, it should look like I've got my own dedicated piece of hardware. I'm not sharing it with anybody. Right? Now, if we do that, then the operating system is then responsible for coordinating all of the activity. So it has to take those multiple threads and map them onto a single CPU. It has to take the I/O interrupts and make sure that the disk interrupt for a particular thread is actually delivered to that thread and not to someone else. So the challenge is, how do we organize everything? And what we're going to do is use an abstraction. Okay, divide and conquer, simplify the problem. Virtual machine abstraction is what we're going to do. So we're going to provide this illusion of a dedicated machine, and then what the operating system has to do is multiplex these dedicated machines onto the single physical machine. Now, by doing this, you'll see it'll make life much, much easier. And in fact, back in the 60s, when OS 360 was being released at a million lines and 1,000 APARs, features otherwise known as bugs, Dijkstra built the system in just a few thousand lines, and he did it by using abstraction. So abstraction is a very powerful concept when it comes to operating systems. All right, so this should be a familiar picture from 61C. We've got an address space here running from 0 to 4 billion. We've got an instruction stream, and we've got some data values. All right, and this is our processor. It's got a bunch of registers, and it's got some microcode that's doing this fetch, decode, and execute cycle. So we fetch an instruction, decode the instruction, execute the instruction, maybe referencing registers or memory if it's a CISC processor. We then write the results to registers or memory if it's a CISC processor. And then we update the program counter to be the next instruction, which could either be just add one word or whatever the size of the instruction is, or it could be a branch, so it might be something more complicated, and we just repeat. Okay, so this is how we get a sequential stream. So moving from instruction 0 up this path. And it might be that we bounce around because there are branches and other things, but there's one thread that runs, or one sequential stream that runs through this address space. Nice little graphic. Okay, so challenges, we've got these abstract virtual machines with shared memory, and we need to emulate them on this single processor system. So how do we provide the illusion of multiple processors running on this single piece of hardware? So what we're going to do is we're going to multiplex them in time. So first, we'll run the fetch, decode, execute cycle for CPU1. Then we'll run the fetch, decode, execute cycle for CPU2 for a little while, and then we'll do the same thing for CPU3. So we're just going to run little snippets of that. Now, from the point of view of the thread, we want it to be transparent. It's just some of the instructions, there's a long gap between when it runs this instruction and when it runs the next instruction. And that gap's because the CPU is actually busy doing something else. But otherwise, there's no way for that thread to tell that it's actually sharing the machine with someone else. So if it couldn't look, for example, at wall clock time, it would have no idea that it was actually being virtualized in this manner. Okay, so in order to make this work, each of these virtual CPUs is going to need a structure to store its state. And its state is going to consist of things like the program counter, the stack pointer, we'll talk about this more in gory detail in a little while, and then the registers, the integer registers, the floating point registers, and then there may be a whole bunch of other registers. Every processor has a set of custom registers and some convention for which registers we're going to have to save. Okay, so now the question becomes, how do we switch from one CPU to another? All right. Well, when we get done running the CPU1, we now want to save all of this state, so the program counter, stack pointer, and the registers, and then we're going to load all of the state for CPU2, its program counter, stack pointer, and registers. And then we'll start running, do our fetch, decode, execute cycle. Now, one of the questions is, how do we switch? And there are a couple of different mechanisms that we're going to look at. One is a timer could go off. Right? So we get this hardware interrupt, we drop into the kernel, and that causes us to switch. Right? Another would be a voluntary yield. Right? So this is like you're in the supermarket, you see two people bring their carts right up to the checkout line at the same time, and one person says to the other, no, you go first, and the other one says, no, you go first, and it kind of goes back and forth. Yeah, right, that never happens. I haven't seen it happen at least. But that's the basic idea. Voluntary yield is you're being nice. It's cooperative Multi-programming is another way of putting it. You're saying, I'm going to give up the CPU. I've had it for a while. Somebody else can have it. So that does actually expose the fact that there is multi-programming going on. Yeah. Exactly. Good question. So the question was, if one thread has no notion of another thread running, how does it know to call yield? Well, the answer is that the illusion isn't perfect. So we do know that we're running in a multi-programming environment, and to be a good citizen, we'll occasionally be nice and give up the CPU. Now, if we're not nice, well, you know, that's the role of the timer here. The timer says, yank, I'm going to take the processor away from you and give it to somebody else. Yes? That's a very good question. So the question is, does the CPU's pipeline get flushed, or do these other threads go into the delay slot? It depends on the architecture. We'll talk about an example in just a moment where that doesn't happen. But you need special hardware support in order to be able to support that. Yes? Yeah, so the question is, where do we save this set of state? And the answer is, we're going to save it into a thread control block. I think that's probably my next slide or so. But we have a special area in memory that we're going to reserve for saving these thread control blocks that contain all the state of the thread. Other questions? Okay. All right, so the other thing that could also cause this to switch would be some kind of interrupt occurs. We could say an I/O event completes, or there are other things. If I, as we'll see when we talk about memory management, if I reference an area that I shouldn't reference, I can get a fault. And that'll drop me into the kernel. Okay, so properties that this simple multiprogramming technique has. Well, one thing is that all of the CPUs, these virtual CPUs, are sharing the same non-virtualized resources, that being the memory and the I/O devices. All right, so this is a good thing. This is also a bad thing. Right? It's a good thing because it means that each thread can access the data of all the other threads. So sharing is easy, right? I can access all that state. But that's also a bad thing, right? Because it means that if my one thread goes crazy and starts chasing wild geese scribbling all over memory, it's going to run a good risk that it's going to scribble all over the memory of the other threads. So they're going to be affected. A good benefit is you can share instructions. So if we're all running Emacs, we only need one copy of Emacs. We just have a separate thread for me, a separate thread for you, and so on. The downside is if you go and change the code, like say to look at all my keystrokes, you can see them. So we lose protection again. So the trade-off here is sharing is easy, protection is hard because we've got a shared resource here. The other problem is also perhaps the threads can go and overwrite the operating system functions and then everything stops. Or in the case of a security model, the threads could then do malicious things that are bad. So this kind of model is very common. We see it in embedded applications where there really isn't much of a need for security and protection. Protection might be also considered sometimes an afterthought in these environments, or sometimes the processors are just simply not capable of enforcing things like memory protection. An 8-bit processor isn't likely to have memory protection capabilities. Even a 16-bit processor probably won't. And then some operating systems. So Windows 3.1, Macintosh, and a lot of others were cooperative multi-programming. So you only switched with a yield. So under Windows 3.1, if your program went south and just started chewing up all the CPU, nothing you can do. Okay, you can do that little Control-Alt-Delete or hit the reset button. Windows 95 and up through the Millennium Edition included a timer. So it was not just cooperative multiprogramming, but you know, if you didn't give up the processor, it got yanked back from you. So that gave you a little bit more capability. But all of these are operating in the environment where if one program starts scribbling on something, it can trash the whole system. Okay, so this actually is talking about the question that was raised about indirectly about delay slots and whatnot. So we have a couple of different architectures that we can look at for CPUs. One is a superscalar architecture where each one of these columns is a functional unit. Right? So it could be an adder, or it could be some kind of ALU or other operator, operating unit. And we've got a thread, and we can do speculative basically speculative out-of-order execution. So rather than executing that stream strictly sequentially, we can speculate on what will get executed, and where we think there is parallelism, we can try and execute things in parallel. We might make mistakes, and so things may have to be squashed, but in general, we're able to do much more within a given time unit than if we were just to execute things on a single ALU. We then have multiprocessors, so you can see there's a little white line between here, but each of these three columns is a separate processor that's superscalar. And so we can schedule thread 0 onto the first processor, schedule thread 1 onto the second processor. And then more recent is hyperthreading, like on the Intel series of processors, Intel Pentium 4, where not only do we have the ability to execute speculatively things from one thread, but we can actually execute speculatively things from multiple threads. In this case, two threads, two hyperthreads at the same time. So we're not getting a strictly linear speed up the way we will with multiprocessors. The more multiprocessors we add, we can execute more threads completely in parallel. But we're getting a little bit better utilization, if you look here, of the functional units than we do in either of these cases. So it's kind of a midway point in between. In terms of scheduling, though, it's cleanest if we schedule each multiprocessor separately. So if we have a dual core chip, then we'd want to put one thread on one core, the other thread on the other core. Okay, now, so that was without protection. Now the question is, how do we add protection? So in order to add protection, there are three important things that we're going to need. So the first is protection of memory. We can't allow things to touch memory of other threads. We can't allow them to touch the memory of the operating system. The second thing is protection of the I.O. devices. So we don't want them to be able to scribble out on the disk, otherwise they could change executables that are out on the disk or change data that's out on the disk. And then the third is we have to be able to force switching, so preemptive multiprogramming. This is where we basically add a timer, and if you don't give the CPU back voluntarily, we take it back forcibly. Okay, so this is what an address space looks like. Several components to it. There is the code component, the data component, the heap. The heap is a variable size structure that grows up typically. The stack, ideally we want to put it at the other end of the address space and have it grow down. Okay, and hopefully the two don't collide in the middle because the address space is large enough. And typical address space will be on the order of 4 billion bytes. Sometimes we reserve half the address space for various architectural reasons for the operating system, in which case the largest address space would then be 2 billion bytes, 2 to the 31. Okay, now, for the memory locations in the address space, not all of them are actually backed by real memory. Some of them, if we try to write to them, nothing might happen. Okay, there's nothing actually there. Others, when we write to them, it stores a value in memory. Some might actually represent I.O. devices. So it might represent the screen, so if I write to that memory, it's actually the memory of the graphics coprocessor, and so writing to it causes a pixel or some other artifact to appear on the screen. Or maybe I'm sending instructions to the GPU through writing to memory. And then finally, there's some locations where if I touch them, it might cause a fault. So for example, if I access addresses outside of the heap space, typically that will cause a fault. And then the operating system will say, oh, you need more heap space, and it'll allocate more memory to the heap. Same thing with the stack. Typically, running off the end of the stack is not a problem. It'll just cause a fault. We'll add more space to the stack. Okay. Now, in order to provide this illusion of separated memory, it's really easy. All we're going to do is rely on the hardware. Remember, we have this nice little piece of hardware that gives us this translation map. So when we're running our first thread, we'll set it up so we're using this translation map. And that maps the code, data, heap, and stack into these regions. And then when we switch, in addition to changing the program counter, the stack pointer, and all the registers, we'll change the translation map to be the other map. Right, so now the nice thing is, not only are we isolating everything that the program can touch and be affected by controlling what's in the registers, but we're also doing the same thing for the memory, the address space for the program. Okay, administrative stuff. If you don't have an account form, make sure you get one from me or one of the TAs. You need to sign up today for the project group, so you're going to need an account form to do that. If you do have an account and you haven't signed in yet, please sign in. You need to sign in so that we can create the grade book and the roster, and we can do the groups. If you don't sign in, we won't know what your name is when you submit the groups. Also, if you're concurrent enrollment, I haven't actually gotten the processing, the email for that, so see me after class. I can give you a form. We need your email address. This is just so your TA can communicate with you, set up mailing lists and that sort of stuff. The reader, I'm still working on it. I think I've posted now a little over half the slides, about 14 lectures worth of slides. So I'm hopefully going to get it done in the next couple of days, and I'll get it out to the Copy Central place. Okay, next week we start Project 1. So start looking at the Nachos code. Start thinking about your development environment. Several people have already said they've downloaded the code and installed it and are starting to play with it. But it's a lot of code. Start early. Don't wait till the last moment. Okay, groups. So again, reminder, groups have to be 4 to 5. They can't be 3. They can't be 6. You know, the goal of this class is to understand what it's like to work in a large group. 6 would be torture. It would be impossible to get anything done. Just to get 5 people to agree on something is going to be hard enough when you have to make hard decisions. 3 would be too easy, so 4 to 5 seems to be about the right number for projects. It's experience, right? I really want you to understand what it's like, the good and the bad of working in a project. Please choose at least 2 sections. It will make life much easier. If everybody chooses 2 sections, we can almost certainly guarantee everybody will get their first choice. If everybody chooses only 1 section, then we may have to break up groups or do something less pleasant. So if you can sign up for more than 2 sections, that would be great, because that'll help us with the load balancing of the sections. If we find a section is completely empty, we'll get rid of it and probably load balance out the other sections, but help us and make life easier for us. Just make sure you get your forms in by midnight. Okay, if you get your forms in by midnight, we'll run our little algorithm and we'll do our little horse trading and negotiating with you guys, and hopefully we'll get everybody into their sections by the end of the week. And this will take over for the section that you were assigned into by Bearfax. And you'll start attending those sections next Tuesday. So this is the list of sections. Okay, any administrative questions? Yes. Can you get confirmation for submission? I don't recall if it emails you. I don't think it does, but it'll put up a little thing that says, you know, you've been added to the file. And, you know, if we haven't heard from a set of, this is one reason why it's also important to register, because if we have a group of students that we haven't heard from when we go to run the program, or if, you know, we have, I think, 127 students in the class, so if we only have 124 project teams, then we'll know something's up. And it's, you know, some people were panicked that they have to get their things in, it's first come, first serve. It's not. You know, we're going to run the program, and it'll just take all of the requests, try to give everybody their first request balanced out. Any other questions? All right, so we're going to take a short break. We'll take like a 3-minute break, and let's start back up pretty quickly. Can everyone sit down so we get started again? Make it quick. Okay. So there was a question about what happens if you can only make one section. The form requires you to fill out two. You're going to have to play Russian roulette and pick the time that works for the largest fraction of your group. And hopefully you don't get scheduled into that time because everyone has to be in the same section. It's hard enough for your TA to meet with you as a group. If you're in different sections, even with the same TA, it's going to be hard for them to coordinate with you. So it's best if you can make two, but if you can only make one, then you know, put down the second one, which is the same TA and everybody can make. Did you have a comment? Yeah, the script won't allow you to sign up unless there are two. Okay, so let's talk about traditional Unix process. In a traditional Unix process, the definition is basically it's an operating system abstraction to represent what is needed to run a single program. All right, so it's typically in the old style traditional Unix process is what's called a heavyweight process. We have a single, just one, sequential stream of execution in its own address space. In English, that means there's just one thread running in the address space. There's two parts to this. This single thread that's running that has the state of the CPU, registers, program counter, stack pointer, and so on, and a set of protected resources. The main memory, which is just the contents of the address space, and then any I/O state, so file descriptors and things like that, are part of this heavyweight process. Now, the important thing is there's no concurrency inside of a heavyweight process. There's only one thing that runs in a heavyweight process. So this makes, again, this is like uniprogramming effectively. We are making the problem go away by only having one thing run at a time inside a process. Okay, we can have multiple processes running, though, at the same time. And the way we're going to do that is first we have a data structure called the process control block, and it's going to store all of the relevant states. So the process state could include things like the translation table, the process number, program counter, stack pointer, registers, the memory limits and translation information, the file descriptors like the active open files. And only one PCB can be active at a time. We only have one CPU, so there's only one process that can be running at any given time. Now, one part of this equation is scheduling. We have to figure out which of these processes are we going to give the CPU to. We're going to spend quite a bit of time looking at different kinds of scheduling algorithms. Round robin, first come, first serve, FIFO, shortest remaining time to completion first, and so on. But there are lots of different things. Basically, the bottom line is maybe we want to give more time to important processes, or maybe we want something that's fair scheduling or minimizes response time. There's some policy that we want to implement that's the scheduling side of things. The other side of it is protection. And this is controlling access to the non-CPU resources. So, for example, memory mapping gives each process its own protected address space, while at the same time, syscalls and traps and the separation between kernel and user mode allows us to multiplex I/O. Right, so we can control to make sure that only one process is able to access the disk drive, or we can control how it accesses the disk drive, or how it accesses the screen, or the keyboard, or the network, or any other I/O resources. Okay, now let's talk about switching. So this is what's called a context switch. On the left here, we have process 0 running, and at some point, it's either going to get a timer interrupt, or it's going to trap, or it's going to do a syscall, or something's going to happen, and we're going to end up inside the operating system in the context switch handler. And what the context switch handler is going to do is first it's going to save all of the state for P0 into its process control block. Right? And then it's going to reload the state for process P1 from its process control block, and then we're going to switch to it. So we're going to jump to its program counter and leave kernel mode, back to user mode. So now we're executing P1. And then maybe a timer interrupt or something happens, does a syscall, back into the context switch routine. And then we save the state for process P1 into the process control block. We load the state for process P0 from its process control block. And then we jump back to its program counter after setting up the translation map and everything, going back into user mode. Okay, so that's a context switch. Now, from the point of view of each of the processes, from the point of view of P1, it was not doing anything. And then all of a sudden, it's running for a while. And then it's not doing anything. And then later on, it's running again. Right? So it's running in these little chunks or slices interleaved with everyone else. Now, everything here, the saving of the state and the reloading of the state, is overhead. Right? This is the cost of a context switch. This is what makes a context switch expensive. We have to save all the registers, save the translation map, load the new translation map, load the new registers. This is what's going to really be a bound on how little work we want to do when we're executing before we go and we switch again. Right? If this takes us 100 milliseconds and we do 10 milliseconds worth of work here, that's not very efficient because we're going to do 10 milliseconds of work, 100 milliseconds of overhead, 10 milliseconds of work, 100 milliseconds of overhead. In practice, it's actually much more the other way around. It's just a fraction of the amount of time that we're going to spend in context switching, but it really sets the minimum practical time. There's a lot less overhead if we use hyper-threading or other techniques, but then, you know, resources aren't protected. Okay, so this is what a process goes through in terms of state. So first thing we have to do is we create a new process, all right? And this means filling in the data structures in the PCB. We'll go over that in a moment. The next thing that happens is we put it into the ready state, which means it's ready to run. Okay, it's been fully initialized, and as soon as it gets the CPU, it's going to be off and running. And then eventually it gets lucky, and it actually gets scheduled. Right? And then it goes into the running state where we're executing the fetch, decode, and execute sequence for that particular process. And eventually we're going to do some I/O, or we're going to yield, or something's going to happen. We're going to go into the waiting state. And eventually that I/O will complete, and then we go back into the ready state. So the data has been loaded from the disk, and we're ready to go again. We just have to wait until we get lucky, and then we get to run again. And then eventually we're done, and we exit. Okay, so these are the different states for a process. Now, we don't actually maintain them as states. The way we actually maintain them is as queues. So that we take the process control block, and after we create it, we put it on the ready queue. And then it gets to run for a while, and then it does some I/O, and it gets put on the I/O request queue. The I/O completes, and then we get put back on the ready queue. Right? Or our time slice expires, and we get put back on the ready queue. Now, the interesting thing, the scheduling side of it, is how do we pull things off of this ready queue? You know, it might just be as you get into the ready queue, first in, you're the first guy who gets to run. Right? Or it could be we pick the thing that's going to do the shortest amount of work, least amount of work to run next. We'll look at lots of different policies. Okay, lots of algorithms, a few weeks. All right, now, what do we have to do to create a process? What do we need? What's in a process control block? Yeah. The instructions. So we have to set up basically the translation map so we'll know where the code is for that process. What else? Yeah. Right. We're going to have to take the program counter and initialize it to point to the first instruction of that process so that when we actually let it run, the first thing that will run is the first thing that should run. What else do we have to set up? Yeah, we have to give it a process identifier. So all of the associated state with a process control block, give it the unique identifier that would be associated with that. What else? Yeah. Put it in the ready queue. All right, so I had construct a new PCB, so that's initializing it with the things like the PID and other things, zeroing out the registers. We have to set up the page table, so where is our code, where's our data, where's our heap, where's our stack located. We have to copy data. Okay, so somebody created us, our parent created us, typically using a fork command. When they use that fork command, what the fork command does is it gives us a complete copy of the parent's memory and I/O state. So what happens if we have a 100 megabyte program? Wow, fork is expensive because we have to copy 100 megabytes. But what fraction of that 100 megabytes really gets touched by both the parent and the child in terms of getting changed? Well, it turns out not very much. So developers pretty quickly realized that what we could do instead was, instead of doing this exhaustive copy, we'll mark all of the memory as read-only. Now, if the parent goes to write something, or the child goes to write something, we'll fault into the kernel, realize that they're trying to write something, and we'll just copy that little chunk of memory and mark it writable for each. Right? So this way, the cost for a fork is going to be proportional to the amount of shared state. Not a lot of shared state. Fork is really inexpensive, relatively inexpensive, because the only thing we're actually going to copy now is the I/O state. We don't actually have to copy the whole memory for the process. Okay. And that's medium expense. Okay, now one of the, yeah. Oh, so that's a really good question. So why does the child process have to have access to the parent's memory? Anyone want to answer that? Yeah. That's where the code is, yes. So we need to at least make sure we've copied over the code. Might we want to copy anything else over? Or have access to anything else. Yeah. Exactly. So if we have global variables that we want the child process to have access to, then this is one way to do that, because it can just simply read them out of that common area of memory that's shared between the parent and the child. And same thing with the I/O state, right? If I open a bunch of files, then my child gets to inherit those files and inherits access to those files. This is important for things like web servers. Right? A connection comes in, and I want to fork off a process to handle that connection. I'd like to have it have access to that connection. So by copying the state, it can then access the connection. Any other questions? Yeah. What's that, OS? Oh, okay, so the question is the operating system one of the processes that's being threaded? Would I want my operating system to be threaded or not? I hear no. Anybody think yes? Okay, why? You can't answer it. Why? Right. So, exactly. So the operating system kernel is doing lots of things on behalf of other programs. So it's scheduling I/O requests. It's servicing I/O requests. It is handling multiple concurrent syscalls from the processes that are running. And so, in fact, your operating system typically in a modern operating system is actually threaded. So you'll have multiple operating system kernel threads that are handling the incoming request. If we only had a single thread, it would mean we would end up blocking on calls into the kernel. Okay, so now we can ask the question, if we compare a process and a program, are they equivalent? So on the left here, I have a program, and on the right here, I have a process. Right, so the program has a bunch of code. The process has a bunch of code, and it has this heap and stack and data area. So that implies that there's more to a process than there is to a program, right? Because the program, in this case, is just a part of the process state. I'm running Emacs, but I'm running it on lectures.txt, and you're running Emacs and running it on, project phase1.java instead. So it's the same program, but different processes. On the other hand, you could say there's less to a process than there is to a program. Okay, because this program over here can actually call multiple processes. So, for example, the C compiler is a program that then turns around and invokes a process to do the preprocessor. It invokes another process to do the first pass compiler, the second pass compiler, the assembler, and the loader. So you can't really say one is larger than the other because a program can fork multiple processes, and a process contains a program within it that's running. All right, so now we're going to take our nice, clean, neat world where we had no sharing, and we did that why? protection, okay, and it was easier, okay, and we're going to allow sharing. Now, as soon as you allow sharing, any form of collaboration, communication between applications, we're going to run into this problem where bugs propagate. So if we allow process 1 to communicate with process 2 and process 3, then a bug in process 1 potentially can propagate over to process 2, can propagate over to process 3. That's the risk we're going to take. But we're going to allow it because real world requires collaboration. All right. Now, the challenge here is this form of collaboration where we have multiple processes communicating has a really high creation overhead. I've got to create a PCB, I've got to create the process, the address space, the all of this work, and it takes lots of memory. Each one of these has a large address space associated with it. Okay. There's also a high cost to switch from running from process 1 to running process 2, because we've got to go context switch through the kernel, unload all the state, load all the new state, and then go back out of the kernel. So we're crossing address space boundaries twice. So what we really want is a communication mechanism. And there are two basic mechanisms. One is shared memory. So we're going to map a little bit of the memory from this address space into this address space into this address space. And then we can just simply write and read from those locations, and everybody will be able to see it. Right? So it's just as if I'm writing on the blackboard. That could be our shared memory. Everybody in the class can see it. Everybody could come up here and write on the board. Okay. The other way is through message passing. So we'll have send and receive messages. And I'll use send a message to another process. I'll use receive to read the message, receive a message from another process. The nice thing about message passing versus shared memory is we can transparently put these processes on multiple machines. Right, so I can have a process running on my machine here, and it does a send to a process on a machine on the other side of the globe. We can do the same thing with shared memory, but it's a lot harder and it requires some hardware support, and it's not nearly as easy to make work. The nice thing, though, about shared memory is the data structures, I just read and write data structures in memory. With message passing, I have to take my data structures, serialize them into some message format, and then send them and deserialize them back into data structures. Okay, so this is what shared memory looks like. We just take our translation map and we add another region which is mapped to the same physical DRAM region. That's all. Very low overhead. It's just memory write, memory read in order to share. Okay. But as we're going to see in a little while, in a couple of lectures, by sharing this way, coordination is going to be challenging, to say the least. Yeah. The question is there a difference between multiple threads in a single process and this example? And the answer is no. So if we had multiple threads running, it would be the same thing. They'd be able to access some shared physical region of memory, and it would pretty much be identical. But we'll get to that in a lecture or so. Okay, so the other alternative is intra-process communication, and this is just a mechanism for these processes to communicate and basically synchronize their activities across processes. It's a way of doing it without having shared variables, and the act of sending and receiving, we'll see later on, is a mechanism that we can use transparently for synchronization. So we know when we've gotten a full message, basically, because we receive messages atomically, we send messages atomically. Don't worry about that for now, but later on that'll become pretty important. There's two operations, the send operation and the receive operation. And if two processes want to communicate, what they have to do is they have to set up a communication channel between them. They have to associate these two endpoints, and then it's fine. Then they can send and receive messages back and forth across that interface. Okay. Now, the implementation of that communication link actually could, underneath, be shared memory. For efficiency, sometimes people will do that. They'll use a send and receive. If you're on the same machine, you just map it into the same region. If you're on separate machines, you use actual networking messages to send it. On a multiprocessor, it might be a separate hardware bus or other operation. It also might be some syscall or trap that's used to implement it if you're going through the kernel in order to communicate. Okay, so actually, I guess we'll talk about multiple threads now. In a modern operating system, we have lightweight processes. And in lightweight processes, we have multiple threads in a single address space. So the advantage is low-cost sharing. The disadvantage is loss of protection. One of those threads in my application fails, it can take the whole application south if it starts scribbling on memory. Okay. It also means that if I'm running threads that I'm concerned about the access that the threads have to memory, like, for example, if it's a grades application or something like that. Well, I might be concerned that, you know, one person checking their grades would be able to see somebody else's grades. So again, this wouldn't be a good model to use in that environment. All right, so multi-threading, single program with multiple concurrent activities. Sometimes it's called multitasking. Ada in particular, which nobody really uses these days, calls it multitasking. But we're not going to call it multitasking. We'll call it multi-programming. Now, yeah.
So multi-threading
and multi-programming? Yes. Okay. Well, multi-programming is having multiple programs running on a machine. Multi-threading is having multiple threads running in a single program. So they are actually different. Okay, so why are we going to separate out the concept of a thread from a process? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One reason is that we can then talk about the active part of a process, the thread. This is going to be what we're going to worry about for concurrency. And then there's the address space, which is passive but provides us with protection from other programs that are running at the same time. It's not going to provide us with protection for the threads that are running, but it'll provide us with protection from other things that are running. Now, the equivalent for a lightweight process to a heavyweight process is when we have a lightweight process with one thread. Now, from now on, when I say process, I'm going to mean a lightweight process. That is multiple threads running in a single process. If I ever want to refer back to Unix processes, I'll say heavyweight process instead. Yeah, question? Okay, so in this case, we're talking about threads that are cooperating. So it's threads within a single process that want to cooperate together. All right, if I'm concerned about that cooperation, then I would put them into separate address spaces, and then perhaps use send and receive or shared memory to restrict the communication that they could do. But if I truly trust them, then I can run them all in one address space. The other huge benefit is when I context switch from one thread to another, it's a lot lighter weight than context switching from one process to another. Because remember, the big difference is I have to change the address translation map when I go from one process to another process. Now, it seems like right now all that means is just, oh, I have to change this map. But what we'll see in later lectures when we talk about the memory hierarchy is we actually have to flush the TLB potentially, we have to flush the cache. There's all this other performance enhancing state that's lost when we switch processes. Yeah. So that's a good question. So the question is, when we switch between threads running within this process, does each one get its own process control block? Well, process control block has a lot of extra state we don't need, so we're actually going to create a thread control block that'll contain just the state that we need to record that thread state. Question? Oh, we're getting way ahead. So when I said flush the cache, what I meant is we have to invalidate entries that are in the cache because the memory addresses, if it's a virtually addressed cache that are being cached by that cache, represent the address space of the currently running process. If we switch processes, it's now a different address space, and those virtual addresses are now that are being cached are not representative. If it's a physically addressed cache, we don't necessarily have to flush it. If it has a thread identifier or process identifier, then we don't have to flush it. But we'll talk about that more in later classes. Yes. Very good question. We'll get to thread control blocks in just a moment, but the question is, does the thread control block have to be part of the operating system or not? And it depends. So in early systems where threads were being retrofitted as user-level packages in Unix, the thread control blocks were maintained in libraries, like the pthreads library. In modern operating systems where threads are provided at the kernel level, the kernel handles the thread control blocks. Okay, so at this point, we'll take a 4-minute break and start up, unless there are other questions. Okay. Okay, let's start back up. All right, so one thing actually I forgot to mention earlier was if you don't have a project group already, hang around after class and we will try to pair up people to get you into a group. All right, so don't have a group, stay late. Okay, so here is a picture of a threads encapsulating the active portion of an address space. So here's a single-threaded process. So this could be a lightweight process with one thread, or otherwise known as a heavyweight process. And then here is a multi-threaded process where we have multiple threads. Each of the threads has its own register and stack, but they share the code, data, and files. Right, so each thread can have its own unique set of program counter, stack pointer, and other registers, its own execution stack, but everything else is going to be shared. And the address space is what provides us with the protection boundary. Yeah, question? Was there a question? Where the heap is. It's the data is the heap. Data and heap are the same thing. Okay, so what this does is this program can crash. Any one of these threads can crash, and the other threads may also crash. We may lose the whole process, but we won't lose the other processes running on the machine. We won't lose the operating system. Now, why do we have multiple threads in an address space? Lots of reasons. Embedded systems, elevators, planes, medical systems, wristwatches, as we found examples. We have a single program, but lots of concurrent activities that are going on. You know, an elevator is getting input from multiple floors. It's got multiple elevator cars that are running. In fact, the first phase of the project was design an elevator controller, basically, doing the scheduling for elevators. We don't do that anymore. Now you get to move people around, but in canoes. Most modern operating system kernels. Like we talked about before, inside the kernel, there are concurrent activities that are going on. There are concurrent requests coming in from users, and we want to be able to service those without blocking other users. But we don't have protection. That's a good thing. That's a bad thing. Database server, for example. Shared data that we want to access, and we want to be able to service multiple people accessing that data at the same time and do it in a very lightweight manner. We have we have control over the language that they're using to execute it, and it's an interpreted environment, and so this might be okay. Other examples, network servers. If we've got a web server, it's a lot more efficient to have multiple threads than it is to have multiple processes. So when a new connection comes in, we can just add a new thread to service that connection instead of having to fork off an entire new process. File servers are the same thing, and so on. If we have multiple CPUs, we might actually split the program into multiple threads for parallelism, but then use a single shared memory image for accessing data, accessing code, and so on. That's called multiprocessing. And interestingly enough, some of these multiprocessors are actually effectively uniprogrammed. That is, we've got all these processors, but they're executing basically the same code, same program. So scientific computation works this way. If I want to compute the state of the universe at the start of creation, Big Bang or whatever, I might have a huge number of processors, each one which is simulating a little portion of the space. They're running the same exact code, but with different data, different stack, and so on, communicating with each other through memory, perhaps. Okay, now, thread state. What do we need to actually keep track of? We need to keep track of the shared state, because this is going to be memory, global variables, the heap, and so on, the I/O state, all of the file descriptors, and then there's going to be private state, which we'll put in our thread control block. So this is going to be our CPU registers, including the program counter, our stack pointer, and so on. The execution stack, if you recall from 61C, is where we're going to keep our parameters, our temporary variables, the return program counter when we call a method or a subroutine or a procedure. And it looks like this. Right, so here's an example of a stack. Here's a program, and we start executing. So first we call procedure A with some value. And that gets stored as a local variable, in this case temp equal to 1, and the return is going to be exit. because this is the first thing that we're calling in the program. So when we're done, the program is done, and it can go ahead and exit. Since temp is less than 1, we'll call B. So we invoke B. There's no local variables. So the return value is just going to be set to the next instruction in A, which would be the printf. And then B will call C. So we create another stack frame, which contains the return value being the next instruction in B, which is just going to be the return. And then that's going to call A with the value of 2 for temp. So we create another stack frame. This time temp is set equal to 2. The return is set equal to this point here, which will then return us back to B, which will then return us back to A, and so on. So the stack in this case is growing down. Typically stacks grow down. They can also grow up. It kind of depends on your architecture, processor architecture. And this is really powerful. This is what gives us recursion. All right. What's the limitation here? Or can anyone think of limitations here? Size of the stack, right? We can't do infinite recursion because eventually we'll run out of memory for these stack frames. Okay, now we can take our operating systems and we can group them into a number of different categories. Operating systems either have one or many address spaces, and they have one or many threads per address space. Let's fill in each one of these boxes. All right, so in the one-in-one case, so one address space for the whole machine and one thread in that address space, are things like Microsoft DOS and early Macs only had a single address space and only one thing ran at a time. Okay, we can also have a single address space but multiple things going on in that address space. So embedded systems fall into this category. There's no protection, but we can do multiple things concurrently. Traditional Unix was the many address space but heavyweight process, so one thread per address space. And then in the modern world, we have things like Mac OS 2 Linux, Windows 9X, Windows NT and XP, Solaris, HPUX, and OS X, where we have many threads and we have many address spaces at the same time. Now, there's a little bit of a caveat here because Windows 9X series did allow you to have multiple pseudo address spaces. You kind of could have multiple things running at one time, and you could have multiple threads in each one of those. But there really wasn't true protection, and so that was bad because you could actually scribble all over the system tables, you could scribble all over the DLLs, and you could easily blue screen your system. Okay. Another way that we could look at things is implementing an operating system in Java. So we'll take our hardware, and what's going to provide the intermediary to map between the complexity of the hardware and the nice API we want is going to be a Java-based operating system. So as a thought experience, let's look at what it would take to do that. All right, so we want to have many threads here, but we only need a single address space. Now, first we could ask the question, why create another operating system? So can anybody suggest why might we want to create, say, a Java-based operating system? Yeah. Marketing. Yes. If your son, Java everywhere. That's definitely probably one of the top reasons why people create operating systems is because then you can market it as different from everyone else's. What else? Yeah. I'm sorry, what's that? Right, we can go straight to hardware from our application from our application right down to the operating system through this JVM. JVM is running right on the raw hardware. What else? Yeah. Exactly. If this is a specialized environment, then we can customize for it. Okay. So the other issue here is we can also design this for a very limited set of functionality. So people have actually built Java operating systems, and they typically run on things like smart cards. not a lot of memory on a smart card. Right. Now, let's say I decided I wanted to run Unix on the smart card. Well, we don't actually need X Windows, but you know, we're talking 32 megabytes in order to run it in terms of memory. Maybe Windows, an early version of Windows, you know, 16 to 32 megabytes. NT was 32 to 64, and 64 to 128. Although, if you actually really try to run an XP system with 128, you have to have a lot of patience. Okay, so this could be one reason, right? If I want to create something specialized, like a point-of-sale terminal. Right, now, does my point-of-sale terminal need to have all sorts of complex functionality, general-purpose spreadsheet editing? No. Okay, all it needs to do is to be able to look up UPC numbers, total things, run credit cards, process checks, that kind of thing. So especially if I'm going to build, say, 1,000 of these, or maybe these are airline terminals, or maybe these are, you know, I want to put walk-up terminals around the halls where people can just walk up and check their mail or something, I really don't need a full-blown operating system on these things. So maybe I just want to have something that'll run with 8 megabytes of memory where I wouldn't even need to have an external memory. I could put the memory right on the processor core and run with that. So those are many reasons why people tend to create new operating systems. So the question is, what do we write? What language do we use? The typical choices are C++. A lot of people still use assembler, especially if you're looking at ASIC-based or FPGA-based processors. Sometimes people will resort to using assembler. In general, mostly, though, people use C and C++. But I don't make you guys use C and C++ for nachos, and there's a reason. When you try to write an operating system in C and C++, you have to worry about null pointers. You have to worry about running off the end of strings and arrays. You have to worry about all of these other complexities, and that means you stay up late debugging your programs. So instead, you know, one could argue maybe we should use something like Java or Lisp. The problem is, unfortunately, Java and Lisp don't allow you to have low-level control over the layout of memory. They don't allow you to access hardware functions. So you really would, you know, when people do build these Java OSs, they have to play a lot of games under the covers in order to allow them to do bit manipulations and to do I/O operations. But it's just a thought experiment. You'll run into this at some point where someone asks you, you know, what operating system should we put on the Xbox, you know, 1000 or whatever the next one is. Okay, so to summarize, there are two parts to processes. There are threads, which give us concurrency. There's the address spaces, which are passive and give us protection. We get concurrency by multiplexing. Right? So we're going to take our CPU and unload current state, load new state, and switch back and forth. This could be voluntary. If we're nice, we'll yield. Or we do some I/O operation that causes us to block. Or it could be involuntary, like a timer, or we'll look at lots of other interrupts that can occur that take the processor away from us. We get protection through memory mapping. Right? If we put things in separate address spaces, we don't get to share as easily, but we can limit the damage when one process fails in terms of affecting other processes. And we'll use dual mode and traps and things like that for isolating I/O devices. Finally, the book talks a lot about processes, but you know, when they talk about concurrency, they really mean the thread portion of a process. And likewise, when they talk about protection, they're talking about the address space component of a process. So the book doesn't really do a nice job, the way I try to do, of separating out active concurrency from passive protection. So any questions? Okay, so again, if you did not already find a group, then hang around after class and we'll try to match you up.